I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. 2 years ago, the U.S. economy, like the rest of the world, was hemorrhaging jobs because of the pandemic. The Trump and Biden administration spent trillions of dollars to prevent everyone from hitting rock bottom. That included increased unemployment checks and child tax credit benefits, payments of $1,400 to most individuals, hundreds of billions to local and state governments, and payments to businesses for lost revenue. Now we're dealing with the highest inflation rate in 40 years, shortages of many goods, climbing mortgage rates, and tumbling stocks. In fact, Moody's Analytics said American households are paying $341 more a month compared to 2021 for the same goods and services. Last week, the Federal Reserve announced the largest interest hike in 22 years to try to rein in inflation. On the other hand, unemployment is low, the labor market is tight, and millions left their jobs for better pay and benefits. Well, here to make sense of what is happening, Rana Farrukhar, global business columnist and associate editor at the Financial Times. She's also CNN's global economic analyst. Rana Farrukhar, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much, Marty. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And also with us is Gina Smilek, and she is Federal Reserve and economy reporter for the New York Times. And Gina, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks for having me.
Rana, let me begin with you, but Gina, I want to hear from you as well. Is inflation the number one problem facing the U.S. economy, Rana?
Yeah, you'd have to say yes. Inflation is something that hits everybody, but it hits working people the hardest. You know, a lot of working people spend the largest single chunk of their income on things like food and fuel and filling up their car and heating their homes. And so when those things are going up, it absolutely becomes a kitchen table issue, let's say.
Well, picking up on what Moody said, I did the math. It's more than $4,000 a year if inflation stays the way it is, Gina. And that is a lot of money out of almost anybody's income in this country.
Right. And I think an important point to keep in mind is that inflation is something that really affects everybody. You know, Ben Bernanke, the former Fed chair, said in an interview with my colleague Andrew Ross Sorkin yesterday, that published yesterday, that, you know, when we have high unemployment, that is something that affects maybe 6, maybe 7% of the population, whereas this inflation is really something that literally everybody is feeling and experiencing.
Here's a question that I think has been hanging over, you know, how we got to this situation. And Rana, I'll begin with you. Did the federal government, both the Trump and Biden administrations, did they spend too much money to deal with the fallout from the pandemic to create the inflation that we're dealing with today?
No. Let me say this.
Okay, fair enough.
Unequivocal terms, no. This is a huge, huge red herring. You know, it doesn't get clicks, but this is a 40-year problem. This is not a 2-year problem, a 4-year problem, a quarterly problem. This is about the way our economy works. We had a pandemic. We should have spent money. Now, we can, you know, dissect the policies of the Trump administration, many of which were ridiculous. I mean, particularly the corporate tax cut that just kind of added kerosene to an already hot economy that didn't need it. That's another separate thing. But when we're talking about short, mid, and potentially longer term inflation, which I think will be with us, we have to go back decades and look at how we have had a policy of low interest rates with a few exceptions for 40 years. We have had politicians of both political stripes that have passed the buck for policymaking to the Federal Reserve because it's easier since the 1980s onward. And that, combined with 15 years of easy money following the financial crisis, is why we are in the situation we were in. And I'm happy to dissect that more. But really, fiscal policy from either administration are at the margins of this debate.
I want to get back to you, Rana, but let me give Gina a chance to weigh in on that. It's interesting to hear Rana's emphatic no, because in preparation for the show, I was reading so many different articles and lots of the arrows pointing at the federal government, our federal government.
Yeah, I would say, and I'm not an opinion writer, so I will quote other people here, but I would say I think many economists would disagree with Rana's take there, actually. I think what we've seen is a decent amount of research that suggests that the size of the package that passed last year at a time when the economy was already healing probably did overdo it a bit, helped to stimulate what economists refer to as aggregate demand. And as demand really soared, you saw that supply chains just couldn't catch up. You know, I think a thing that often gets missed in this conversation is that, in fact, we imported more goods from abroad than basically ever before in our history last year. It's just that demand for goods was so extremely intense that supply chains were not equipped to keep up. And so we had shortages, as the listeners probably are very conscious of. It was very hard to buy a car last year. It was very hard to buy couches, furniture, many things that we import or import parts of from abroad. And that really contributed to the inflation last year. Now what we're seeing is a situation where that inflation is broadening out as supply constraints sort of continue and persist. But at the same time, we see companies feel that they have a little bit of pricing power. We see that consumers are still buying pretty aggressively. We had a very strong retail sales number this morning, for example. And so we've seen this really collision of strong demand that has been helped by some of the things you mentioned up at the top, those $1,400 checks on top of additional checks. And so we have seen some, I think it's hard to imagine a case in which those sort of financial helps for households didn't contribute some part of this inflation. And obviously the solution, however, does seem to be the Fed. You know, it's unlikely that these supply chains are going to be resolved overnight. And so you have to sort of work on the demand side of the economy. And that's where the Fed can be really effective.
Well, going back to Rana, supply and demand, can we say that consumers unwittingly, because of demand and having, in some cases, some extra cash going after limited supplies, that helped to fire up some of this inflation?
Marty, let me clarify a couple things.
Sure.
For starters, I'm an opinion writer with 32 years of reporting and three books covering all these things. I really feel at this point I want to get away from the quarterly details of the problem. Of course, we have some supply chain issues. You know, we had COVID. We have a war in Ukraine. We've had a shutdown, a China that's been locked down asynchronously with the rest of the global economy. But again, these are long-term problems, and I just don't think that we're serving anybody by trying to dissect what's happening in the week or the month. You know, we have an economy that has been built on low rates and easy money. I am in the financial markets every day. I talk to the top investors in the world. They think that that is the problem. Supply chain issues are going to work themselves out, but frankly, supply chain issues are also connected to the financial markets. And so, you know, it's all a very large picture. And I just want to keep coming back to that point. I know it's not the quick soundbite, but it is the real story.
Well, and you're talking about just the fact that we've had, as you describe it, easy money, which has made it really easy to borrow and probably has inflated the stock market, things like that, Rana?
Yeah, I mean, you know, think about the way our neoliberal economy has worked for the last 40 years. We basically took some decisions in the 1980s under Republicans. The Clinton and Obama Democrats then basically doubled down on those decisions to have an economy that was built on consumption and to outsource production. That's globalization status quo. That's all changing now. Everything about that is changing. China has decided it wants to have its own, what they call a dual circulation economy. That means that they're going to keep more of their own consumption and production locally hubbed. Europe is you know, being rejiggered in all kinds of ways. Lots of long-term supply issues there. The U.S. is, I think, on both sides of the aisle, doubling down on doing more manufacturing at home, thinking about having production and consumption more locally hubbed. All that is going to change the entire nature of how the economy functions. And to me, that is a real story that I wish Americans would really dial into.
Well, I appreciate going back and forth because you both have important things to say. Let me go back to you, Gina. And I remember, you know, a year or two ago, or perhaps we learned, for instance, with some of the government payouts during the pandemic, that child poverty in this country actually went down in a pretty profound and dramatic way, that there were things that the government did that really mitigated, I think, a lot of suffering. And now we're kind of in this very different reality.
Right. And I think when you talk to people within the administration, they will often say things to the effect of, to the extent that we've had more inflation, we also had a stronger recovery. So I think they've kind of pivoted away from saying that this response wasn't at all responsible for inflation, but they've been making the point that we were taking out an insurance policy. You know, early last year, the economy was definitely recovering. It was pretty clear that things were getting better. Some people were, like, including most notably Larry Summers, I think is the one everybody remembers, were out there saying that, you know, this package is too big. But the administration's, you know, argument at the time, I think I'm fairly representing it, was basically, you know, we could get another really bad variant, things could get a lot worse, and we're taking out an insurance policy. And I think, you know, as much as we can talk about what that might have meant for inflation and how that's affected the situation now, I think it's also important to point out the facts that, you know, poverty did go down, child poverty went down, hunger went down. We've seen, you know, labor has been enjoying what is one of the strongest job markets for workers in generations. And so we have seen some very positive outcomes here. We did have a really fast economic bounce back. The extent to which that's been faster than the rest of the world, I think, is something you can debate in the data, but it's certainly the case that it was much faster than most people expected it to be.
Well, Rana, picking up on that and using your global perspective, how did our recovery and even the economy today, how does that compare to, let's say, our counterparts in Europe or parts of Asia?
Yeah, it's a great question. So our recovery was hotter, but that's because America, policy-wise and kind of philosophically, tends to favor growth over stability. So if you look at the way Europeans handle the crisis, they tend to try and preserve employment, you know, try and keep the jobs numbers high. You know, oftentimes, interestingly, in countries like Germany, you'll have the public sector, the private sector, and labor unions coming together and saying, let's put people on furlough, let's pay, you know, 2/3 salary and keep them, you know, rejiggering factories or retraining. And so that creates lower growth, but it creates a more of an underlying stability. In the U.S., you tend to have boom-bust cycles where hiring happens very quickly, but firing happens quickly, too. And so you ramp up when things are back more quickly, but oftentimes there are these kind of underlying fragilities in the economy.
Oh, dear. I think we lost Rana Faruhar. Let's see if we can get her back. I'll tell you what, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation. Rana Faruhar. Again, she is global business columnist and associate editor at the Financial Times. She's also CNN's global economic analyst. Gina Smilek is with us and she's Federal Reserve an economy reporter for the New York Times. We are talking about the U.S. economy, the global economy. It's all interconnected. And as always on Radio Times, we want to hear from you. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And you can pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. We're particularly interested in hearing how the U.S. economy, or perhaps even the global economy, is affecting your bottom line. So stay with us. We have much more to talk about, including the Federal Reserve. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Gina Smilek and Rana Faruhar about the U.S. economy, the global economy as well, because we're all interconnected here, focusing on the problem of high inflation. And again, we want to hear from you. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can pick up the phone and give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9444. Ron, I know we were talking about Europe, but I do want to just shift gears slightly here because we've been talking about inflation, and I want to talk about the Federal Reserve and the role that you think it has played or perhaps hasn't played in trying to tamp down this current inflation. What are your thoughts, Rana?
Well, you know, let me start by being fair. I think the Fed is a great organization. It's a great institution. It's not that the Federal Reserve leaders themselves have somehow, made bad policy choices or done something or not done something wrong to the economy. It's that they have limited tools. The Federal Reserve can basically influence the money supply. It can pump more money or contract the money supply. And what that does is it can bolster asset prices. So, you know, just to kind of talk about what happened after the 2008 crisis, you have low interest rates. You have a lot of money being pumped into the economy, something called quantitative easing, you know, technocratic term. That happens again after the pandemic. And what that does is inflate the price of stocks, inflate the price of houses. That's something we can all feel around us. But that tends to benefit mainly the people that own those assets. It doesn't change the story on the ground. It doesn't create new products. It doesn't build new factories. It doesn't retrain workers. It doesn't rethink how we deal with the global trading system. Those are things that only the executive and congressional branch can do. We look to the Fed for everything. I mean, politicians of both stripes look to the Fed and try and blame them, pass the buck on economic policymaking, and then blame them when it doesn't go right. We need to understand that their tools are limited. And until we get past the kind of gridlock that we have in Washington right now, there's going to be increasingly less that can be done with economic policy.
Well, Gina, how do you see those tools that the Fed has?
Yeah, I mean, I think that obviously the Fed has two big categories of tools. They have just plain Jane interest rates, which everybody's familiar with. They can sort of raise and lower the short-term borrowing rate in the economy, and that trickles out through the rest of interest rates. And then they have, as Ron was mentioning, quantitative easing, QE, which is their bond purchase program. And like she was mentioning, that does really play out through financial markets. But I think if you talk to a Fed official, they would say that the critical thing it does is it lowers long-term interest rates, which can make it more attractive for somebody to invest in a factory or, you know, buy some equipment, et cetera, et cetera. It certainly does play out in the housing market. It lowers mortgage rates, and we see people buying more houses when mortgage rates are lower. And so I think those tools can certainly have some effect on stimulating demand. I think especially when it comes to QE, you are seeing an increasing amount of debate in the economics community over how effective it is and whether the trade-offs are worth it, because, you know, it is the case that it does run a risk of blowing up asset bubbles. And so I think those are real questions we're asking. When it comes to inflation, I think the question is even bigger. You know, I don't think we have a really good understanding as a society of what role those QE purchases play in pushing up inflation, partially because we did QE for years after the global financial crisis and we got basically no inflation. And so just, you know, just experimentally, I don't think we've had a really, really good set of experiences that would teach us how this affects inflation. And so I think there are going to be a lot of debates and a lot of questions about whether they overdid it on that side this time, but I don't think those debates have sort of come to fruition yet. I don't think we actually have an answer to that question. But
oh,
it's certainly
gosh.
Something we're
totally
all going to be talking about.
With that.
Well, hold on. Yeah, let me give Gina a chance to just finish your sentence there. Go ahead, Gina.
Yeah, well, I said I think that this is going to be something that we continue researching in the years ahead, but I don't actually think that there's a consensus yet.
Go ahead, Rana.
it's funny. My whole first book was about financialization. We've been waiting for the inflation bubble. It's true. We've been waiting for a while. It's now here. Marty, have me back on the show in a year, in 3 years, in 5 years. We're going to be fighting inflation. it takes a while for, first of all, the academic research never catches up to these questions for like two decades. So we shouldn't even be thinking about the academic research. We should be looking at where traders are placing their bets. Most of them are the richest and the people that understand the financial markets are placing their bet on higher inflation longer term. We have brewed up an asset bubble of unprecedented proportions. The financial markets are now, depending on the day, between 3 and 4 times the size of the real economy. I defy anyone that is using inductive reasoning to tell me that that is not going to cause inflation.
Go ahead, Tina.
Can I respond to that?
You can. Go ahead. Yes.
I would actually love to ask you to clarify something, Rana, because asset bubbles and inflation aren't the same thing. You know, when we talk about inflation, we're typically in the U.S., we're talking about either the consumer price index or the personal consumption and expenditure index, both of which track consumer prices and don't include investment vehicles. So they actually don't even include owned housing, but they definitely don't include stocks, bonds, et cetera. So I wonder what you see as the connection there.
Go ahead, Rana.
They're connected in the sense that when asset prices go up, it is, I mean, it depends on how you want to think about this question. I'm trying to basically pull away from the details of the moment and say we're living in an economy in which we have used debt to prop up consumer demand, which really hasn't been growing, like, in any sense for the last 20 years or 40 years. I mean, think about wages. The average American, you know, and let's put aside the wage inflation of the pandemic era, because I think that that's actually probably going to change as companies shift to technological displacement. We haven't had average wage increases in 20 years. Working people haven't really gotten a wage hike in 40 years. And yet, you've had all this easy money in the economy propping up asset prices so that the rich get richer, inequality grows. Now you have the system starting to break down. That happened with trade wars. It's happening with the war in Ukraine. That creates inflation in real things like food and fuel. At the same time, that wages really can't keep up with that. I mean, the kind of wage inflation we have is so minuscule compared to sort of energy and food inflation that we have. And yet the asset bubble continues to grow because the Fed has limited tools. I mean, that's the way to look at this. You have to look at it as a whole picture. How have we run the economy in the last 40 years? I just don't think it's useful to, like, focus on these kind of technocratic definitions of core inflation, you know, real inflation, what's happening this week, what's happening in the quarter. Pull the lens back. We are moving into a post-neoliberal world. Globalization is changing, financial markets are changing, supply chains are changing, labor markets are changing. This is a 70-year pivot point. We're going to look back and say everything changed in the way that it did in you know, the 1930s and 40s and 50s, for example.
Well, Ron, and I do want to get back to Gina, but what you're saying is that inflation, it may not be as high as it is now, but inflation beyond the sort of I guess healthy inflation is here to stay. Is that your bottom line?
Yeah, that's my bottom line. And it's because the world is changing. The world is, think about energy markets. Okay. You know, you have a war in Russia. A Russian war in Ukraine, you know, that is not going away anytime soon unless Europe decides to shut off the Russian energy spigots. That's going to keep gas prices high. That's going to push people to do more regionalization, more insourcing. You know, China is still locked down. You've got countries building semiconductor chip factories, you know, that they used to outsource. I mean, everything is changing. And I'm sorry, I know that I keep focusing on the big picture, but I just think it's so important for people to really pull the lens back. It's not about this administration. It's not about the Trump administration. It is about a 70-year pivot point.
No, and I appreciate, you know, the big perspective and the small perspective, because I think they're both very valid. Gina, let me go back to you. And I was reading that I think in 2021, something like 40 million Americans left their job. left their jobs, many of them finding a job with better benefits, better pay, sometimes flexible hours, and were enjoying some of the benefits of having a better job. And then, of course, inflation hits, and then you go to the supermarket or you go to the gas station, and there goes your pay raise.
Right. And I think, you know, I think that there actually are some really big step back trends that are worth emphasizing here. I do think it's important to sort of, if we're going to blame those things on easy money, to explain how we're doing that. But I will say, you know, to your point, I think that we are seeing some clearly a situation where we have fewer workers and workers have more power than they did previously. It does seem like a lot of that owed to the pandemic. A lot of people lost their jobs overnight. There was a big reshuffle in the labor market. And now as everyone kind of settles back in, we're seeing these crazy wage gains, really great wage gains for workers from a worker's perspective. But we're also seeing this crazy reshuffle in product and service markets and not enough stuff to go around. And so we are seeing the situation where you have very strong wage growth on one hand, very high inflation on the other, and it really feels pretty bad for consumers. I think the big question is this big reshuffle that we've just seen a temporary situation that's going to settle back down and we basically go back to sort of the, I don't know if they're the good old days, but the moderate old days of the 90s and 2000s, 2010s, where we basically had 2% inflation or lower and 2% growth or lower. And, you know, everything was kind of very humdrum, but predictable. Or are we in some sort of new world order? Have things fundamentally changed? Did the pandemic just speed up a situation that was already evolving? And I think to Rana's point, we are seeing some signs that that might be the case. You know, I think one thing that's really interesting is sort of this trend toward friendshoring or away from globalization. That's clearly going to have big impacts if to the extent that it happens. And I think the other thing we're seeing is a big demographic shift globally. You know, the working population in the world is getting older. There are fewer untapped pools of cheap labor. And so as we move away from globalization and as there are fewer and fewer factory workers abroad that we can just sort of outsource jobs to, I think there are real questions about what happens next with wages, what happens next with production, and what that all means for inflation.
Well, let me toss something else out. And Rana, I'll put this to you. What about the impact of climate change on the global economy, even the financial systems? Thinking about all this, you know, the storms, the heat waves, the fires. Sure. I mean, how do we factor all that in as we look forward and look globally?
Yeah, that's a great question and a useful thing to explore. So two things. Climate change is being priced into the financial markets now. Insurance companies are previously had, you know, picked up a lot of the slack for the growing number of disasters, the cost of those disasters. Now they're basically trying to push the cost of that onto companies. And you're starting to see companies, unless they have real plans for how to deal with being in flood zones or how to deal with the emissions costs of their supply chains, which, you know, you're seeing regulators like the SEC and regulators in Europe try and bring forward pricing, real carbon pricing, and companies to have to really account for that on their balance sheets. You know, at some point, I think we're probably, I couldn't put a time period on this, but we're going to move to a situation in which it's going to be very easy for people to see almost like a nutritional label on a company, what the emissions cost of that company is. That then starts to really give us a much clearer sense of what is that cheap thing that you just bought in Walmart? What's the real cost of that? What's the emissions cost? How many units of emissions did it cost to get that from somewhere in the South China Seas? How much less did you pay for that 3-cent mask because it was made with child labor in Xinjiang, you know, versus being made by, you know, union workers in, say, South Carolina? These are all the things that we're going to start seeing. Now, in terms of what climate change will or won't do to inflation, ultimately, I think, and I'm talking like if we get our act together and actually shift away from fossil fuels, it would be wildly deflationary because you would be able to, you know, produce energy locally using renewable resources. Sadly, in the short term, it's going to be inflationary because as we shift, as we make that transition, there are going to be supply chain issues. There's going to be higher energy costs in the short term, you know, because of the war, because of the resurgence of economies. So it's complicated, but ultimately, I mean, I think this is a tremendous opportunity. And this is something that, again, often gets lost in short-term debates. You know, when we talk about a Green New Deal and conservatives often say that's going to be inflationary. Yeah, maybe for 5 years. Mm-hmm. In 20 years, it's going to mean you're going to pay nothing for your energy. You know, that's what we need to be focusing on. China is focusing on the long-term PS. We need to do a little more of that.
Well, that's interesting. Let me read a couple of comments, and they're all related. And Gina, I'll start with you. Patty says, the inflation wouldn't be such a frightening matter for me if my wages were also rising. They aren't. People can be squeezed so hard before they can't afford to live. I know things are complex, but from where I am, it feels like profit tiering and price gouging. Stu says, according to Robert Reich, 80% of current inflation is caused by corporate overcharging. Another listener gave us a tweet. It seems like no one wants to talk about the huge percentage of inflation that's being driven up by corporate profits. Mm. And then from there, but Gina, let me give you a first crack at those related comments.
Yeah, I think this price gouging story is one of the most difficult ones in economics right now, because how do you define price gouging? You know, I think that's the really hard question that we're all trying to answer, because what we see is that there is not enough supply to go around, and that companies have, you know, pricing power, and that they're exercising that pricing power to charge a lot more because they can, because people are, for whatever reason, willing or able, or, you know, enough people are capable of meeting those high prices. And so that is kind of how, you know, capitalist systems typically work. And so I think the question is, you know, when do we get to a point where this is not the kind of system we want to have? And I don't think anybody that I've talked to, at least, has an easy answer to that question. You know, at what point where do you go from just acting like a company in a capitalistic system to price gouging? And I think that's a pretty fuzzy dividing line.
Well, and Ron, we're almost up in a break here, but, you know, one day it's $4.50 at the gas pump, and then the next day it's $4.75. Is that price gouging? How would we know?
You know, again, if you're trying to use traditional neoliberal economics to think about these things, economists love to, you know, plug numbers into models and think that they can come up with some perfect solution. Is price gouging if it's 470, but not if it's 430? Not really. Just look at power. You got to look at power, and that's actually what the Biden administration increasingly is trying to do. Look at corporate power. We've never had higher level. I mean, maybe in the Gilded era, but, you know, since then, we've never had as high of levels of corporate concentration as we have now in our economy. That gives companies power, and that's why you need antitrust action and trust busting, which the administration is trying to do, thankfully.
And that's Rana Farooqar, and again, a global business columnist, also an associate editor at the Financial Times, and CNN's global economic analyst. Gina Smilek is Federal Reserve and economy reporter for the New York Times, and we are talking a lot about inflation, but other issues related to the economy, our financial system, capitalism, and, of course, economies in the rest of the world. You can join us. Any questions or comments or stories about your personal finance, email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. You can also call us. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne talking with Gina Smilek and Rana Farooqar about many aspects of the U.S. economy, our financial system, and, of course, the global economy and financial system as well. Gina, let me go back to you. I ran across a quote from Jerome Powell, the chair of the Federal Reserve, who said, and this was actually in the New York Times, that sometimes businesses are raising prices just because they can. Do you think there are companies, though, that are taking advantage of the inflation? Because I think for consumers, you lose track of, you know, should a gallon of gas cost $7 or $3? You know, I have absolutely no idea. Do you think there are companies taking advantage?
So I think it is unambiguously the case that there are companies who are looking out and saying, hey, I can charge a lot more than I used to be able to. I can swell my profit margin. And they are doing that. Like we've just clearly seen examples of that in earnings calls. I think Avis, the car rental company, is one example. They've been swelling profit margins, but a lot of companies just across the board. I think the question is that something that we don't allow in this system, basically? Because I think the way that we tend to think about companies is they try and go for their biggest profits. Like corporations were always greedy. That is how they are. And so I guess the question is, like, is corporate greed something new? Probably not.
No.
What is new? Like, why can they be greedy now? And I think that's the really important question to answer.
Well, and Rana, that raises questions about, I mean, if the Federal Reserve has limited tools, then you got the rest, which is, you know, in Congress and whatever president is sitting in office. What can they do to deal with price gouging?
Yeah, well, actually, this goes back, and Gina has made a nice segue. Why can they be greedier now? Because of corporate concentration. It's wildly higher than it has been. It's been growing for the last 40 years, but particularly the last 20 years. And that's why the administration has appointed some really key people, Lina Khan at the FTC, Jonathan Cantor at the DOJ, Tim Wu being the White House advisor on antitrust issues. There is definitely a sense, I certainly have noticed it again in my three decades, of growing concentration, too much power being in the hands of too few companies, which, P.S., is also a product of the neoliberal system that we've been talking about. And that's why I keep trying to set the frame bigger, because it's all connected. Outsourcing over 40 years allowed there to be fewer and fewer companies in charge of things. You actually saw this play out in an interesting and problematic way during the pandemic. If you remember when the pandemic first hit, you know, you had restaurants closing en masse, but then you had all these lines at grocery stores. Well, why did you have that weird supply and demand thing where there wasn't enough food on the shelves in grocery stores, but suddenly restaurants are throwing things away and farmers are dumping milk? Because you have a handful of ag companies, you have two very siloed supply chains that don't talk to one another, and too much power in too few hands. So that's, I think, what the administration is doing, which is spot on, is to look at concentration of power and really think deeply about how to create a more even playing field.
Let me go back to you, Gina, and put something else on the table here. We've been focusing on inflation and thinking about the Fed and, frankly, all of us, which is, I mean, the opposite of that in certain ways is a recession. How do we sort of walk that fine line between the right amount of inflation but staying away from recession?
Right. So I think this is going to be a real challenge, because basically I think if what the Fed is trying to do here is they are trying to slow demand in the economy down to a point where supply can basically catch up. Mm-hmm. And so in order to do that, they're raising interest rates, they're cooling things off. And it's very difficult to do that without doing it a little bit too much. And so I think that the real concern is that as the Fed makes borrowing more expensive, as it becomes harder to buy a house or expand a business, we're going to see a real slowdown in hiring. We're going to see, you know, a real pullback in markets. And as consumers and businesses become less confident, that's going to precipitate an outright recession. And I think that most economists you talk to on Wall Street right now will tell you that, yeah, they think it's more likely than not that we're going to end up with a recession out of this. When you talk to the Fed, they'll say, you know, we know it's going to be very difficult to pull this off without a recession, but we're hopeful that we can do it. So I guess, you know, maybe not the most optimistic prognosis, but it's certainly something they're attempting to pull off.
Well, Ron, you know, how do you walk that tightrope then? Or can you?
Again, long-term problem. You know, it used to be, if you go back several decades, recovery and boom and bust cycles, slowdowns and then recoveries actually happened in shorter periods of time. They were sort of like 5 to 7 year cycles. And that was healthier because then you had a more frequent but less intense culling of, you know, businesses that maybe needed to go out of business, weren't doing so well, allowing for new ideas and new companies and new jobs to be created. Then you had shifts that allowed the Fed more control over the business cycle. They stretched it out. I mean, I've done numerous columns on this, a lot of academic research to support this, stretched out the business cycle. You know, we all want that. I mean, mm-hmm. Who doesn't want a recovery cycle to last longer? The problem is that then we get to this very tricky point where it is a much tougher tightrope to walk. And there is a pretty good chance that by trying to slow down the economy, you have a market crash, and it's very painful. And yes, I do think that's where we're headed.
Gina, I ran across the word stagflation, which I haven't seen, frankly, in years. First of all, what is that? And is that something we should be on the lookout for?
Oh, it's everybody's favorite word right now.
Apparently, yes.
Yeah.
So, it's a scary word.
It sounds like. Yeah, a combination of stagnation and inflation. So basically, the idea is that you have an economy without very much growth, with pretty high unemployment, but at the same time with high inflation. And so not the kind of economy we have now, which is one with very strong growth, very low unemployment, but very high inflation, but a situation where basically everything is kind of bad. And I think most famously, this happened in the 1970s and early 1980s. And that is when we saw Paul Volcker, who was then the Fed chair, take interest rates up to crazy high levels.
20%, right? Wasn't it 20%?
20%, about 20%, yeah. And it also pushed unemployment up into double digits in order to restrain the economy and bring inflation under control. That was a very painful adjustment process. And I think that's why this is such a scary word to people, because, you know, there is some muscle memory of just how bad that early 1980s experience was and how, you know, painful it was to get out of that stagflation. And so I think, you know, everybody is very nervous in talking about, you know, is this what we're headed for this time? And there are real questions, because as we've talked about over the course of this show, you know, even if the Fed can choke off demand, there are a bunch of other things happening in this economy that could keep inflation high for a while. And so the real question is, are we headed for a period of pretty slow growth but pretty high inflation as the war in Ukraine continues, as supply chain disruptions persist? And I think, you know, unfortunately, that seems like a distinct possibility at this point.
Rana, you had mentioned Europe, and I know there are, you know, a bunch of different countries in Europe, and they're doing different things. But nonetheless, having... you know, maybe not as quick a recovery as they've as we've had here in the United States, but is more, I guess, what, long term, more stable. Are there lessons from Europe? Not that we would necessarily apply them, but at least that we should think about going forward.
Yeah, well, you're quite right that Europe is a complicated place and each country has its lessons. But let me give you two points that I think are useful to think about here. When you go back in time, let's set aside the war and the pandemic. When you go back in time, America tends to prioritize quick hiring and firing. We want things to happen fast.
We are an impatient people. Yes,
we are an impatient people. Drives me crazy sometimes. But so we allow companies to hire and fire quickly. We don't have a lot of labor protections. That tends to create faster recoveries and hotter recoveries. But it also means that, for example, after the great financial crisis, when China recovered from that, which happened first, that was the country that kind of came back growing first, German manufacturers were able to sell more quickly to the Chinese and actually grab market share because they never laid off workers. They furloughed them. They came together. They have a totally different system, much more collaborative labor and private sector system. The public sector gets involved too. There's kind of a sharing of risk. And so that's an example of, you know, prioritizing stability over super high, super quick growth. Now, Europe, unfortunately, has a problem with the political economy right now. Germany in particular made a terrible bet in counting on Russia for its energy supply. And it's now rethinking that. That's going to be painful for them. And there's really no getting around that. America's going to do better because we have food, fuel, and consumer demand. Europe doesn't have that altogether right now.
Here's a comment from Aaron. He says, price gouging is not a mystery. It's just looking at gross margins. Very simple. PJ says, well, what about diesel costs? And then he talks about Russian gas and what's happening in Europe. And then Tom has a question. Does a hot, overpriced stock market stoke inflation over confidence? Gina, do you want to respond to Tom's comment there?
The inflation overconfidence?
Yeah,
absolutely. So I think actually the connection between asset prices and inflation is really an interesting one, because you do often see them going sort of hand in hand. But it's interesting because, as I mentioned earlier in the show, asset prices aren't actually part of inflation. And so it does seem to be the case that, you know, when you get to sort of the top of a business cycle, when things are really going well and the economy is cranking, that's the moment when stocks are likely to be high. It's also the moment when inflation is likely to be high. And so it does seem seem like those things are related, but they're more related because they're both related to the strength of the economy than directly because those asset prices are directly feeding into inflation.
You know, Ron, I've seen this phrase, I'm sure you have as well, the stock market is not the economy. Is that true? Can we say that?
Yes, that was my first book, Makers and Takers, How Wall Street Tanked Main Street. You know, it's kind of interesting because one thing most average people probably notice is good news in the real economy. You know, job numbers are up, wages are up, tends to be bad news on Wall Street because it compresses corporate profit margins, which makes stock prices go down typically. They're totally disconnected. They've become more and more disconnected over time. I was actually talking to Heather Boucher, who's a member of the President's Council on Economic Advice, about this topic. And she was noticing, which is very true, that when you go back to the 70s, the story of the country, of companies, and of consumers, but I would actually use the word citizens, was much more similar. Let's say if the country was growing at 2% or 3%, then, you know, companies and individuals were kind of feeling the same growth trajectory. Now that's totally different, right? You can have the country growing at 2%, but you can have certain companies growing in high double digits, and you can have some individuals feeling more like, hey, we're in a 6% economy if we're living in the Bay Area and we're working in tech, or maybe we're in the minus 1% economy if we're, you know, somewhere in the Rust Belt and we're living in a hollowed out factory town. So a lot of bifurcation right now. That's one of our big political and economic issues.
Well, Gina, I'm thinking of people listening to us who are, you know, have some concerns about their income and their future. And I know you're not in the advice business, but, you know, we've painted a worrisome, certainly a complicated picture going forward. What do you suggest people do?
You know, I think one thing that is important to keep in mind is that this high inflation that we are experiencing right now, you know, obviously is extremely painful. Mm-hmm. But as long as the government gets it under control in a timely manner, I think there's every reason to think that this experience won't be as painful or as scary as the 1970s and 1980s were. And the reason for that is we had a really long period where we didn't take care of the problem in the 1970s. We basically went for a full decade of just not dealing with this. It does not seem to me like any part of the government is you know, hopeful to repeat that experience this time. It does seem like everybody, whether it's the White House or whether it's the Federal Reserve or kind of whoever you talk to, they're very attuned to trying to address these problems. It is something that people are talking about regularly and very conscious that we need to do, even if it takes a little bit of short-term pain in the adjustment. And so I think as long as that remains the tone, I think there's a hopeful story to tell where this is obviously a very painful adjustment process right now, but maybe we will get through it without too much delay.
How do you see it, Rana?
Well, I guess I'll answer your question, which is what individuals can do. Pay down your debt. It's going to get more expensive to hold debt. Interest rates are going to be going up for some time, I believe. I think we are in a Volcker moment where the Fed and the president together are saying, yeah, we're going to fight inflation, whatever it costs. That means higher rates. One other practical point. Don't go into a lot of debt for education right now. I think that's something we could do a whole other show on that. That's something that's really going to change in this new world. The conventional wisdom of spending a ton of money to go off and get a 4-year degree, particularly in something like liberal arts, you know, as I can testify for, it doesn't always get you a high salary. That's changing. I think we're going to see a totally different kind of educational system. Get some skills. Think about things in a creative way. Be entrepreneurial. The labor markets are changing. The geography of work is changing. Education is changing. We are at a 70-year pivot point. Topic of my next book, by the way, Homecoming, The Path to Prosperity in a Post-Global World, out in October.
Well, and Gina, just picking up on that, and a minute before I have to say goodbye, should people then think of being their own entrepreneur, even if you end up working at a company, but to think like an entrepreneur going forward?
Oh, that's an interesting question. You know, I think people should, you know, do whatever they think that is the reasonable thing for their career trajectory. I think people tend to know their own outlooks pretty well.
Well, we live in a complicated and changing world. My thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Rana Faruhar, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. And she is global business columnist and associate editor at the Financial Times and CNN's global economic analyst. And Gina Smilek, thank you very much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome. She's Federal Reserve and economy reporter for The New York Times. Rana Faruhar has a book coming out in the fall, and Gina Smilek has a book coming out next year. Well, go to WHYY.org to look for more information about Radio Times, including programs. You can also download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Thank you so much for joining us.